going. This is Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. You're listening to The Money Show. Happy Saturday. The weather stinks, but the show's going to be nice.
Not too bad.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Greg, we have some huge football games going on in the NFL this week, and I know you're wearing your LSU stuff, but NFL football, I have some financial backstory.
Well, do you ever really see me wear NFL stuff? It's rare.
I
wore a Saints jersey once this year.
Super rare.
I'm not a fair weather fan, but NFL's over.
Yeah, dude, your wardrobe totally called it. It's all LSU this year.
But yeah, I was meant to look earlier to check, see what games, was there NFL games today? So I guess you can share that with us.
Okay, 8 teams are still in it, 4 from the NFC, 4 from the AFC.
Some are playing today?
Yeah, I think there's 2 games today, 2 games tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
But check this out. The quarterbacks, there's only 8 of them left, and if you divvy them up, in the NFC, the 4 quarterbacks, none of them, Gregory, none of them are on their rookie contract. If you go to the AFC, 3 out of 4 are on their rookie contract, and the other one is Ryan Tannehill, who's only making about $2 million a year either way. You know the discussions we have on this show.
He's kind of been the journeyman.
Yeah, what's his fifth team maybe?
Yeah, I don't
already?
Know, but he was in Miami, and you know, of course, Miami didn't do well.
No. Okay, so check out this list. Patrick Mahomes, Deshaun Watson, Lamar Jackson, Ryan Tannehill. That's the quarterbacks from the AFC. Now, in the AFC, they all got to the divisional round of the playoffs by playing this game where you get your quarterback as cheap as you can, and you use the extra cap space to put the pieces around them. In the NFC, they did the opposite. They're like, go out, pay whatever it takes to get one of these quarterbacks, because none of them are on their first contract. Whatever it takes, we're just going to get the most skilled guy that we can at quarterback, and if we can't afford more pieces around it, hopefully his talent will keep us up at that next level, even if we can't have the money to bring in some other talent we'd like to bring in, better receivers and whatnot. So that is starkly different, AFC and NFC. Let's look at the average per year salary. This is all written up on Sports Illustrated. It's brilliant rundown, the financial backstory on these quarterbacks. Quarterbacks in the NFC, Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, Kirk Cousins, Jimmy Garoppolo.
The youngest is Garoppolo.
Yes.
As far as from
right and
starting point. But the others, I'd call, they're all veterans.
Seasoned veterans. Been there. Jimmy Garoppolo makes $28 million. Kirk Cousins makes $28 million. Aaron Rodgers, $33 million. Russell Wilson, $35 million. That's on the NFC.
Would you consider, how would we describe them? Good quarterbacks or game managers?
Good quarterback. Definitely good quarterbacks.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even put Kirk Cousins in the game manager category, and he's probably the least skilled of them. All right, so their salaries range from about 28 to about $35 million is their average per year. On the AFC side of the ball, Patrick Mahomes is making $4 million a year, Deshaun Watson $3.5 million a year, Lamar Jackson $2.5 million a year, Ryan Tannehill $2 million a year. That's right, Russell Wilson is making 17 times as much money on his contract as Ryan Tannehill, and they're both in the divisional round of the playoffs.
Yeah, and I think he's more of the game manager type. He's got to prove himself to get into that upper tier. And the others, the other three you mentioned, once they get out of their rookie contracts, yeah, they have raises coming. They're going to get into that 20 to 30 million a year range.
All right, so the guy that wrote this article I'm referencing from Sports Illustrated, Albert Breer is his name, makes a brilliant point in the fact that, hey, you remember when Baltimore, you know, they actually won a Super Bowl not too long ago. It was when the lights went out in the Superdome. Remember all that? The next year, they had to pay Joe Flacco one of these gigantic contracts. And then they were irrelevant after that because they didn't have money to put the pieces around him. All of a sudden, Joe Flacco isn't the quarterback anymore. They have Lamar Jackson in there at $2.4 million a year. They actually have some money to buy some other pieces. They're back in the game. For some people, if you go overpay for a quarterback and you don't get every dime that you paid for, that will destroy your team. We see other people do it.
Here's the decision, though. And you know, a great quarterback makes a difference, but he can't do it by himself. But it is a difference maker having a Breeze, Brady, Favre, Manning. Think about that.
Oh, yeah.
Those make a difference, especially when you get into games where you know, they're chunking the ball and have elite receivers blocking. You know, that's going to be super difficult to defend. And then, you know, when it kind of gets to that last minute, these guys can win the games at the end. They pull it off. Now you go back to Baltimore before Flacco. They won a Super Bowl with a game manager.
That was the Trent Dilfer Super Bowl, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That poor guy. That's what he's remembered for, getting the game-managed Super Bowl.
Hey, how many teams get rings every year?
One. And he got one.
So it doesn't matter. It is a team effort. You go to, let's take it back to the college level. You know, are these college teams to show up and win, are they always winning championships with elite quarterbacks? How many of Alabama's quarterbacks are starting in the pros?
Zero, right?
Yeah.
I think we're at zero.
Yeah, okay.
Good point.
Point made.
Yeah, nailed it. All right, so there's the financial backstory behind some of what's going on in the NFL. But something that we watch on this show is how much dead cap space you have. The financial backstories are usually a lot bigger than you think. That's what this show's for. And this is one of the things that happens when you do get one of those big Joe Flacco contracts. Here's a paragraph I highlighted. The Ravens won playoff games in each of the 5 years he was on his rookie deal, Joe Flacco. They made the AFC title game 3 times, won the Super Bowl in those seasons. Then Baltimore had to pay him, and they missed the playoffs 4 of the next 5 years. And then this is the 6th year after that. Now they're back in the playoffs after Lamar Jackson's in the lineup. So, boom. Just keep that in mind when you're watching the football. The guy asked the story here, the columnist, Albert Breer, asked if we're heading into a new era of quarterback churn to where, look, I'm going to go get my Patrick Mahomes or Deshaun Watson or Lamar Jackson. We're going to pay him $2-3 million a year. And then when he gets off of that rookie contract and he wants to get paid, go let someone else take that big risk. Because now it becomes a huge risk. And the thought process is maybe you're better off just going and trying to find the next pretty good quarterback at $2 million a year who's just getting started out. I don't know if you're going to do that through the draft or whatever. But can you see that we turn into a quarterback churn system like we have with running backs? Because running backs, you can just let them go. There's always going to be another good one for pretty cheap.
We go back to the great quarterbacks. There's not 32 of them to go around. And that's where they've got to make the decisions to manage those quarterbacks. I would say Dak is going to get paid because he probably proved his worth. But if they were so sure about him, they probably would have done his deal earlier in the season because other quarterbacks that were in his same draft class has already been paid. Think about that. So why did they defer that? They're not absolutely worth sold on him doing so. So he's going to get paid upper tier money. The question is still, is he upper tier player in that case? And that's where you get back to, we got to manage the quarterbacks because there's not 32 Drew Breeses around there. So that's something that you're going to see, even if somebody could mess up and give somebody a 10-year guaranteed contract. Look at Jacksonville and what they've done with quarterbacks the past few years. It's a mess.
Poor guys, yeah.
And overpaying. During the week, we have this show running weeknights at 7. We do a money show for about an hour every evening at 7. I'll just go ahead and tell you, Monday's best of. Everybody's going to be watching the championship game, so we're going to do a best of.
Oh, the curling championship, right? Where they...
Yeah, it literally is Tiger football Monday night. Clemson Tigers against LSU Tigers. But if you're on Facebook Live or Periscope viewing our show right now, you know who I'm favoring. And that's the team that's literally lit it up. I'm using literally a lot. Okay, they lit it up all season. Nobody shut them down, and so that's the big test.
But if they literally lit it up, that means they took light bulbs out there and turned them on. If they figuratively lit it up all season long.
I'm just trying to use literally a lot.
I love that. It's
word of the day. Maybe not a good one there, but I feel people in Cincinnati, since we were talking quarterbacks last segment and money, they have to be kind of excited. I know the question is, does Cincinnati take Joe Burrow, or is it Chase from Ohio State, that defensive end rusher?
Is it really even close? Do you take Joe Burrow?
I know. I see the articles, and that's why. Which do they take? No brainer. If you have a chance to get an elite quarterback, you take him. How many of those chances come around? And look, it may not play out that way, but it sure looks good. It looks. I might be slightly biased, but y'all seen the numbers on Joe. He looks to be the best to have ever played the position on his stats this year as a college quarterback.
How far is it from Cincinnati to Athens, Ohio?
150 miles.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Athens is about 158 miles from Cincinnati by car. 130.
Yeah,
miles.
So he grew up there, was playing for Ohio State for, well, he was on their team for a couple years, wasn't playing. That's why he came down to LSU and showed what he can do. And now he gets to go back home, play almost for hometown team, you know, 150 miles away.
That's hometown team.
Yeah.
Wow.
That is pretty much a while, just over 2 hour drive away. Let's see, what was Cincinnati? I'm looking up Cincinnati's dead cap space this year.
Oh, tell them what you were telling me on the break here. I'm telling you,
$13 million was the dead cap space.
Not too bad.
In 2019 numbers, Minnesota $7.2 million, Dallas was $10 million. I was just kind of looking, and when you look at some bad teams, Miami Dolphins dead cap space $66 million, New York Giants $55 million, Arizona $50 million, Jacksonville $36 million, Pittsburgh $34 million, Cleveland Browns $32 million, Denver $31 million. Baltimore's done pretty good with $29 million in dead cap space. But when you see big numbers like that and you wonder, why is my team not winning? They don't have players. They spent that money on past players that were mistakes. And that's part of managing money, is they have to manage those buying players. And does that go well or not? It's decisions, you know, you think about from a household standpoint, decisions you've made and spent money on, and that money went away. It's just like buying a car and making a mistake and saying, gosh, I'm in year two and I have to unload this thing. That's going to be super expensive because of the loss in value. You know, when you're thinking about buying a car, you need to think 3 to 4 years out, so you could spread that money going down in value over that time. So that's, you know, when we talk about NFL teams making mistakes, individuals make mistakes on purchases and figure out that, oh, I've got to unwind this, get out of this. And you're having to eat some money when you make a mistake that, yeah, I bought this little car, but I need an SUV. Or you buy an SUV and, you know, I really need a little car that gets gas mileage. I hate this big car. You know, making those errors.
Isn't that a bad feeling when you're still making payments on the car you used to drive? Someone did we talk about the stadiums and whatnot on the show. And I remember researching the when they came out with the new Meadowlands Stadium, they were still paying off the bonds that they issued 30 years ago to build the original Meadowlands. They haven't paid off that debt, but they've already knocked that over and built the new Meadowlands Stadium before they finished the payments on the previous one. Wow. You think if you would have told the taxpayers of New Jersey that, yeah, we're going to build a stadium, in 30 years the stadium's going to be gone, but the debt you're still going to be paying on it, you think they would agree to it? There's some big football fans. I'm not saying they wouldn't have, but it would have been a lot tougher decision, I think, right? And you want to know how long this week is, Gregory? Think about how long it feels since you had the lunch and learn about Social Security.
It was Tuesday.
Right.
This week.
Doesn't that feel like about a month ago? How much has happened since Tuesday, right?
Yeah, quite a bit. A lot happens every day, actually.
But we haven't talked about it on the Saturday show. And what the guy that's listening needs to know, even though this is an event that already happened, it was such a success. There was so much demand for this. The waiting list is so long that you've already scheduled another round of lunch and learns. And by round, I don't mean you're having one. You're going to have two on Social Security. We're trying one for the lunchtime. And then we heard what you said. If that doesn't fit in your schedule for the first time, we're going to try a later one. And that's the 5:30 one? Is that what we're looking at?
Yeah, that looks like that's scheduled to be at 5:30.
Okay, so that's perfect. You get off work, you maybe go pick up your spouse and then meet in Metairie at the Gregory Rickson Associates Annex.
And some of those that are aware, you know, the State of the Union is that evening at 8 o'clock. So plenty of time to do the Social Security event, 5:30 to 6:30, and then head back on. And if your thing is to hear the State of the Union, you'll be home.
All right, so that's coming up February 4th.
Plus, I have a show to do at 7 that evening.
Yeah, you better be back in time for the show.
As well, so I have to do a live radio show the evening of February the 4th. Well, think about this from a corporate debt standpoint. We've talked about this in the past, but since we're talking about debt, dead cap space and such, you know who the number one is.
Is it AT&T?
It is AT&T. Total debt, $191 billion. Long-term debt is $178.5 billion. Ford, which surprised me a while back, does it now, but Ford surprised me with having $159.7 billion in debt. $104 million of it is long-term debt.
$104 billion, you mean?
Yeah, $104 billion of that. And Verizon is in third place behind that. And think about GE, problems they've had over the years. They have $111 billion in total debt. GM is six. Apple is seven. Well, you know, correlating to what's the, you know, Apple, basically a $1 trillion
company,
right. But they have $100 billion in debt. So
that's nothing for them. They have that in cash.
Yeah. Compared to, you know, and I'm just kind of correlating it also to market capitalization. Walmart has $75 billion. They're probably, what, the world's largest retailer out there?
Yeah. Literally.
Literally. Literally. Okay. There's that word again.
Love it.
So here's another one. Surprise. Charter Communications, $75 billion. Microsoft at $74.9 billion. Amazon, $58 billion. Just kind of go out there and some that might just surprise you. Number 48 is First Energy at $20 billion. Caterpillar, $36 billion. McDonald's, $45 billion. Coca-Cola, $45 billion. So that's some ideas of companies out there with debt.
So I was thinking of these debt loads, and what I was thinking of the debt loads, and I was thinking of the pension obligations that are hanging over these companies. More specifically, Ford, GM, Chrysler, because something happened this week. I saw it on Business Insider, saw it on MarketWatch, saw it on Fox Business. It was getting a lot of play this week. Tesla's recent rally pushed its market value to about $85 billion, which makes it not only the most valuable U.S. car maker, most valuable U.S. car maker of all time. The previous record was held by Ford in 1999, and Tesla now is worth more than Ford was then at its peak.
And it isn't based on what Tesla's doing today. It has to be priced in what they think Tesla's going to do in the future, and I think that's a rocky road.
Brutal.
Where you have everybody else coming in line to compete with them. They're forcing everybody else to change and make adjustments. But, yeah, that's priced in. How far out? I don't know that is priced out. But it's several years out for they get to meet the projections of such a lofty stock price.
Well, if you're the guy that's buying a stock right now and you want to go get a car company, you can look at Ford, which is has the number one selling truck for the last 30 years. They have all kinds of sales, all kinds of revenue coming in, but they also have how much in debt, and they also have how much in pension obligations that, mathematically speaking, do not look like it's going to be solvent on a long enough timetable, versus Tesla, who's not really selling that many cars, who isn't really making that much money, but they don't have a big giant piles of debt hanging over their head pulling them down, and they don't have giant pension obligations.
And I would not expect them to have pension obligations in the future. You're seeing companies shed that, not add that all.
They're going to have to, because all the companies that do are going to go under. I mean, that's what took Sears under. That's what took Toys R Us under. That's why Ford and GM have been struggling more than anything else. GE had a problem with it. But look, Tesla is not the most valuable car company in the world. They're about $85 billion right now. But Toyota is the largest, as far as market value goes, largest auto company in the world. 232 billion, clearly bigger than any U.S. automaker. And Volkswagen's even bigger than all the U.S. automakers, including Tesla. Its value right now is sitting around 98 billion. Tesla. What a storyline that is, huh? All right, Gregory, coming up in the next hour, we're going to be joined by Wes Blanchard, and we're going to go over the Secure Act, some rule changes that happened to your financial world. Can you just give like a rundown of some of the stuff that people need to know about?
What are we?
Just a quick bullet points, like a super quick, maybe 2-minute version of what we're going to go into the next hour.
On the Secure Act?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the stretch IRA going away. How that affects estate planning is really an important thing to talk about. And overall planning, you know, and I think in estate planning, tax efficiency has to be thought about as well. Because are you making decisions that's going to cost more or less taxes? You know, trusts themselves, if you leave money inside that trust, they're going to be taxed at max tax brackets. So, and then, you know, along with the Secure Act, you have other major changes, such as the age RMDs are required to start. And that's a big deal to do with estate planning and large IRAs as well.
Yeah. So a bunch of rule changes. Part of the agenda on this show is to keep you updated in the financial world. And that's what we're going to do in the next hour, but we're going to do it with a buddy of ours, Wes Blanchard, estate planning attorney. So if you have questions on anything financial, anything investing, Social Security, Medicare, pension buyout offers, that's what Gregory's for. Wes is going to help you with things like wills, trusts, powers of attorney, legal questions. So if you want to go ahead and jump on the phones, it's 504-260-0995. Or you can give us a call or text from the front screen of the Winning at Life app. For those of you, if you keep listening and we don't come back after the news, that means your affiliate doesn't carry all of our shows all the time. That's okay, too. You can continue listening on the Winning at Life app. You just go download that app, no cost. And on the front screen, little button says Listen Live. It really is that easy. You just click it. And I made it simple because I was thinking about you when I made it. All right? So join us for the next 2 hours of the show. And if, of course, something else happens and you got to go away, I'll put it up on the podcast this afternoon. Is that a pretty good deal? All right. Gregory, I think I'm going to watch the championship game at home. Is that what you're doing?
I have great seats. I'll be watching it at home.
Have you been to a football game? And I know you've been to a lot of the LSU games, but you feel like you miss stuff because you don't get to see all the replays?
I attended all the LSU home games, every game, every play. So I have pretty good seats, decent seats, considering, you know, the place holds 100,000 people, and I felt really good about the seats. But, you know, you don't get replays, and you're seeing it quite a distance. There's no close-up shots for you sitting in your seat. So I always record the games and actually go back and watch them, and I want to hear commentary and bits and stuff. Oh, okay, that's why that happened. Oh, I see now what happened on that play.
And my bathroom has a shorter line.
Oh, tell me about it.
I'm James Parker. We're Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks. The first thing I want to run by Wes Blanchard is, in the Secure Act, they took away the stretch option from the IRAs. That seemed to be a very useful tool on people being able to control these large accounts and have them last longer than 5 years. Yeah, now it's going to be 10 years. Right. So one of the things Gregory and I have already talked about in the months since this passed is, well, okay, that's what we were planning on. It got taken away. What do we structure to get something similar out of it?
Yeah, and these are the conversations that, you know, you need to speak with an attorney and a financial advisor almost together to sort of formulate a plan. And one of the things that I certainly have heard you guys talk about on the show and Gregory and I have spoken with or spoken about, I should say, is using life insurance as a way to sort of restructure the same concept and really have that payout be protected in some of the same ways that you were able to do when the stretch was available. So just to kind of recap, obviously you had the stretch available before the Secure Act passed, and what was happening was IRA inheritance trusts were being set up for some families, where in essence the stretch was almost mandated by the beneficiary. The effect of the trust was that the stretch was the option that was selected, and the beneficiary was the trust. There was really no ability to take the lump sum distribution, and so you got a lot of benefits out of that. From the estate planning side, it's what you were focused on and articulating, is that you were able to control that money for a lot longer. And then from the financial planning side of things, you're getting the prolonged tax benefit that is the entire point of the stretch provision. So now the SECURE Act upset both of those abilities, and the time has come to sort of start looking for the adjustment that is available. I don't think so far that there's an absolute equivalent to what the stretch provided, but you are still able to mitigate some of the losses that you would have otherwise incurred, you know, had you not been able to stretch.
Let's go with a couple of exceptions. There's more than a couple. Five classes of eligible designated beneficiaries that are exempt from the 10-year post-death payout rule. And we're talking about the stretch going away. So now the payout rule for beneficiaries, except for these exceptions I'm going to give you, they have to take the money out within 10 years. They don't have to. The thing about a Benny having to start RMDs, their RMD is year 10. It's the remainder of the balance of the account. So you could start taking distributions immediately. You could, from a planning standpoint, you could plan to take it out probably over 10 years and try to manage tax brackets. Otherwise, if you just leave it and forget about it, year 10, you're having to take out the balance of that account, which could really put you into major tax brackets. So the first one that's exempt is what we would think of would be the surviving spouse. The surviving spouse does not have to do the 10-year spend down. Minor children, but not grandchildren, up to majority. Once they reach age of majority, the children as Bennies, their 10-year clock starts that they have to spend down the money. Disabled individuals, they're exempt. The chronically ill. And the fifth one is beneficiary not more than 10 years younger than the IRA owner. Probably a sibling, something to that effect, I would think, would probably fall in that category. So why were people wanting to set up and have control? The two really big reasons. They wanted post-death control of the money.
Right.
They're dead, but they still wanted to have control, meaning I don't, here's a phrase, you know, if my son came into all this money, it would kill him. You know, it's something like that. Or people don't want you to be frivolous with their life's work. Think about it. It's like, you know, I don't want them to, that would so bother me if I knew they were going to go through that money quickly. So having post-death control can, and that's a couple of big reasons. And the other is to minimize taxes, especially trust taxes.
Right. So those considerations, I think, are, like you said, what was driving the initial planning. And here we are now with the same considerations, but some of the tools that we've previously had to address those have been removed.
Now, we're not talking about everybody was using trust, but who was doing it is typically large IRAs were left to protect and preserve those large inherited IRA balance far and from beneficiaries. Minors, disabled, spendthrifts, credit or financial problems, lawsuits, divorces, second marriage, or other vulnerable beneficiaries who may be preyed upon is what the trusts are. And, you know, this is sometimes I'm saying, you know, yeah, I don't like my kid's spouse.
Yep.
I've heard of that before as well. I'm sure you have as well, Wes.
Yeah, that is something that definitely pops up quite often. And look, if you're in that situation, I'll tell you the same thing that I tell folks who come into the office. Generally speaking, you know, it's a tough subject to bring up. It's sort of emotional. They really feel bad for feeling that way a lot of times, and it's not really something they're proud to say. Trust me when I tell you, you know, you're not alone out there, right? That's just a fact of life sometimes. We don't get to choose those partners, but you do have the ability to craft a plan so that you can make sure that your life's work is not necessarily headed their direction, so to speak. So keep that in mind. But I think when you look at what the actual effect of the Secure Act is, you know, you have to ask yourself, what were they trying to accomplish? And I think it really just boils down to taking out that ability or removing the ability to tuck away large sums of money from generation to generation. Even if it's just from one generation to the next, they realize that that lifetime stretch provision is a big deal. And I think it's something worth discussing. We can dive into that a little more when we come back. A
lot of changes just happened at the beginning of this month, and we're keeping you caught up on it. Not the funnest or the sexiest topic to talk about, but this is probably the most important function of this show because there's money at the end of these decisions.
Right. And look, sometimes nerds are useful, right? This is kind of our day job is figuring this kind of stuff out.
It's our time to shine.
Right, right. But just sort of circling back towards the end of the break there and trying to figure out what the objective of the elimination of the stretch was, I think you hit the nail on the head from my perspective. I think that it was sort of a reaction to the tax cut. Now they understand they're going to have to get some money back in at some point and make up for lost ground.
If they're going to delay required minimum distributions, that means they're going to be foregoing some tax money for at least a year and a half or whatever.
Well, that's why I brought that up months ago when the first word was talking about, yeah, they're going to push back RMDs. And I don't remember what the numbers were, but we looked into that. And it's a considerable amount of money just pushing that back the 2 years. And next thing we know, oh, the stretch is going away. Well, I think all along, that's really what they wanted to do because of those big IRAs. They want those things spent down and accelerate those taxes that are out there because it's common to see million-dollar 401ks out there. So that means it's common to see million-dollar qualified accounts. So having that stretched over 30 years or so for non-spouse beneficiaries, that's a lot of money.
Right.
And they need the tax revenue. So that's really, okay, we give you a bone. Now we're going to take the house from you. You know, dumb analogy, but that's kind of what they're doing.
I think you're right on. And it makes the most sense, right? And so you're in line exactly with what I'm thinking, which is you have to get that money back, especially this generation. You know, as this generation is coming towards the end, we understand that, like you said, there's going to be large pockets of wealth kept in these retirement funds for folks who have done the right thing for years and years and years. And there's a realization that we can't, as a country or as a national economy, allow that money to just be trickling in every once in a while. We want this thing to continue stimulating the economy, and we need to do this in some accelerated manner. So it brings me to think, well, as you said, the first bits and pieces you guys were hearing about this revamping of the retirement strategy that was allowed here was the pushing back of the RMD. Well, I think they were just, like you said, all along looking to do the stretch. The stretch, I think, was the golden prize. And they said, here's how we're going to offset that. Here's how we're going to do something to you know, make that a little easier on you. We're going to push this back a little bit. I really think that was the first thing that they were trying to do because I think it has the larger of the two impacts when you consider it.
I think you're giving them too much credit. I think that I think they just wanted more tax money. They're not thinking long term, like, well, this could stimulate the economy more. You can make the case either way on that one, though. Does it stimulate the economy? What was it doing when it was sitting in an IRA? It was invested in stocks and mutual funds and ETFs and, you know, financial products. You start giving it to, you know, the juniors, the millennials that are inheriting it, you're taking money out of the market. That's not good for the market.
Can't tax it until it gets to them. And that's what I'm saying. That 30-year drip.
That's what they're worried about. That's what they're worried about is the taxes.
Right.
Yeah. The economic stuff is they didn't even put as much thought as you put into it on the show. They didn't put that in the whole year that they've been trying to pass this.
Yeah.
I don't even think that entered the debate. But one of the things we've talked about on the show before is that once we have all these baby boomers who get to that 70 and a half milestone and they have to take money out the market, Well, that's going to necessarily be downward pressure on stocks as all these IRAs are getting liquidated and it is getting passed on and someone's buying a car with it or spending it on their house or spending paying down their student loans or whatever. That money's getting sucked out of Wall Street. And one of the probably accidental benefits of the Secure Act pushing back the RMDs is that day of reckoning got pushed back about a year and a half.
Yeah. According to the Congressional Research Service, the lid put on the stretch IRA strategy by the new law has a potential to generate about $15.7 billion in tax revenue over the next decade. That is just a short look at that, but that money's going to be shifting for decades, and yeah, it accelerates that spend down. People have to think about it. They have to start planning for that. They have to think about when they have the large accounts, and for a lot of savers, they do, is how is that money going to be handled? Now, people, overall, the reality is that, and I see this a lot, hear this a lot, I'll define it this way. You know, I want to leave my house to the parents, to my kids. We'd like to just peel the income and keep the assets intact and leave that behind. For most people, honestly, that's not realistic unless you have large enough assets accumulated and live within the ability of what the accounts can generate. But still, this isn't everybody. So we're shrinking the amount of people, but that's quite a bit of money generated, over $15 billion within 10 years. So they have to start thinking about, and you'd ask me earlier, what some of the ideas I like on handling these accounts now that the stretch is gone. Two core things. I'll go back to tax bracket management. And if we have a plan for tax bills, can we within close range of your tax bracket start shifting money? And we definitely don't want to waste margin. And if you've got room before you hit the next tax bracket, say you've got 15 or 20,000 in room, you should shift that money, not wait till it's forced later because you have increased income in RMDs, or it gets burnt when it is shifting after you die at higher tax brackets when your kids inherit that money. The other way, and this has to do with health, if you're in good health and you say, well, gosh, I don't need this money, I'm planning on leaving it behind. Well, you're leaving behind a tax infested mess is what it is. And it's going to get spent down at higher tax brackets. Life insurance has one really, really neat thing about it. It pays a tax-free death benefit. And you can stretch that money out forever in a trust, can't you?
That's right.
You absolutely can through that. You can set up a life insurance trust for it to pay out. But you think of, I don't need that money. Well, start taking a distribution and paying a life insurance premium that could pay out and build it to, okay, well, I want to leave behind my $5 million IRA. I want to leave behind my $1 million IRA. Well, create a life insurance trust and get life insurance coverage that either replaces that money in whole or replaces the taxable portion of that at death. And you wash out the taxes. And you could cover, well, this is going to cost the account some money. Well, replace that as well. So that's where you start thinking differently about life insurance there to fix the broken parts. I think it shifts life insurance back into an important role in estate planning.
I would agree wholeheartedly. And just to sort of condense that down a little bit. So the two options that you would propose for using life insurance would be, one, to either replace the entire plan that you initially had in mind using your IRA when the stretch was available, or two, to use an insurance policy to offset the tax that your heir would otherwise incur. And so that would make a lot of sense if you compare it in essence to someone who has a home that they're going to leave, but they want to make sure that their heir inherits that home without a mortgage. And so what they do is they take out a life insurance policy on themselves, and that, or maybe that heir does, and it's designed to pay down the amount of the mortgages owed. It's really the same exact concept, right? You're making sure that that asset is passed on either, you know, in a tax neutral way or as close to that as possible. Those are, I think, two brilliant options when it comes to life insurance. And I think you're 100% right when you say that life insurance, which has kind of been not on the outs, but maybe not the primary tool when using estate planning in conjunction with a financial plan, has now been thrust right back into the mix. And I think is definitely something that is worth considering if the stretch was part of your plan initially, if you're looking to really hold on to that beneficiary's inheritance and dole it out over time. Or really, honestly, like you said, just if you're looking to make sure that you kind of tuck away that tax burden back into the life insurance premiums and you're good to go.
I don't know a whole lot about life insurance trusts. Tell me about those. How does that work? Because I'm under the impression life insurance might not be too compatible with trust because trusts don't have an actuarial table and life insurance requires an actuarial table. So explain how all that works.
So the concept is simply that, you know, what you're doing here is paying out, you're paying into a life insurance policy. You're paying those premiums, at least in part, if not in full, with the RMDs that you're required to take. Okay, so the IRA account holder's going to have to take these RMDs, and they open up or take a life insurance policy out, pay the premiums down. On that life insurance policy, you can name a trust is the beneficiary. Okay, so the trust is there set up as the beneficiary to receive the life insurance proceeds when that time comes. The beneficiaries of that trust are, in essence, the same heirs that you would have named as beneficiaries when the stretch was around.
But are you paying the premiums for your life insurance from the IRA?
While the IRA account holder is alive, that's right. The okay. RMDs are used to pay the premiums down. And then ultimately, when the IRA account holder passes, that policy pays out into the trust. The trust is created for the benefit of the policyholder.
Okay, heirs, I see. Right? So at no point does the IRA nor the trust actually own the life insurance policy,
that's
right?
That's it.
Okay, it stays under your ownership.
That's it. And so from that perspective, you're still able to use your IRA to achieve the same estate planning goal that you initially had and you were going to use your IRA to do when the stretch was around. Okay, so
right, and that's just a long way of saying if your ultimate goal is to parcel out that big pile of money to your heirs in bits and pieces longer than the 10-year span they allow, that's what we're building here.
That's correct.
All right, so life insurance trust. You can see why I would get a little confused there because the trust doesn't actually own the life insurance.
That's right.
But I see. I got it all explained now.
Yeah. So a really good tool, I think that they ought to be and should from here on out be considered a lot more heavily when discussing how you plan to pass that IRA on. The tax bracket management is very important, but it's still limited. It's still limited to that 10-year window. And what the other option that we just discussed gives you is the ability to think outside that 10-year window.
Now you got my – do you see the wheels turning in my head? Because now that I see the life insurance trust and what's going on with that, I'm just thinking
– You don't necessarily have to use a life insurance trust to do the life insurance. Now, what's the estate planning exemption? It's what? $11 million a person.
$11.4 million, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're going to have for somebody with big estates that's going to have an estate tax problem, you definitely want to put life insurance into the trust. And it's life insurance. I used to say, you know, it used to be for estate planning, but because of that, it kind of took life insurance out of it because for most people, they're not ever going to have estate tax issues. But considering if you're wanting to have control of that money, also is having a trust to disperse that money over time as well. So it also takes that life insurance trust would take that money out of the estate, pushing it into an estate tax problem as well, because it could possibly have a large life insurance policy for that purpose. One of the things is it gives you back control and it shifts the tax status of the money because, you know, it's money's still going to make money and should and create taxable income, but you're not going to like leave behind a $5 million life insurance policy and, oh my gosh, that's a big tax burden. It's a tax-free death benefit. But what we're trying to do is how do we fix the taxes on the IRA and have money that's left behind? And now it brings life insurance back into estate planning overall, even for large estates to handle that, but more about handling taxes and creating leave behind money that can be very valuable to family, can be become multi-generational gift if you build a strategy to do so. Now, one thing about it, well, what about the wife? Well, one thing about it is you could leave her a complete tax-free death benefit that the qualified accounts are paying for, and then she says, well, I don't want that tax-infested money. Well, honey, leave it to the – we'll just defer that, leave it on to the kids, take a pass on the IRAs, leave them the tax-infested accounts because we fix this. We're leaving you a big tax-free account when something happens to me before you. I die, move on before you. Most guys are. So just however you're thinking about that in family. So those are some thoughts right there in that the wife could be given tax-free money and she defers the tax-infested accounts. Or overall, you're strategizing how to take and leverage that to create a larger leave-behind estate that you can control. You don't have to leave that money in a way that it's going to like, oh, it's going to do damage. They're going to go through the money. You can fix all of those things. Now, somebody said, well, you know, I've had like 10 heart attacks, cancer three times. I'm not going to be able to get life insurance. I made just a super extreme case of that because everybody's not going to qualify. It's better when you're healthy or minimal problems or problems under control. With that said, then this needs to be about managing tax brackets and strategically shifting money over time. Can you solve it all? No. If you could shift everything to Roth, which is a big tax bill, but if you could strategically do that over time, then you're leaving behind tax-free estate. So even if they're having to spend it down in 10 years, it's not going to create big tax problems because you've managed that and solved that or shrunk that money down.
Right. So I think, you know, what you're getting at there is if you're going to use the Roth route or if you're going to use the life insurance route, it's best to get on that horse now.
Yeah. This is something we talk about. This isn't going to change back. Like, I'm sorry, we're going to tax all everybody's monies and we're sorry. We're going to put it back like it was. That ship has sailed now. You're not going to see the stretch again, I don't think, ever. So tax planning, tax efficiency has to be thought about, and you need to start planning this now on how you're going to shift that money. And it goes for somebody that's 25, 30, or 35 years old saving and saying, yeah, I plan to have a few million dollars built up when I retire. Well, darn sure don't do it all inside of your 401k in the traditional account. You need to think about accumulating money in that, maximize that, but you also need to think about how can I accumulate Roth money and how can I build up after-tax accounts together, which also creates efficiencies when you do that in estate planning also.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is just, I know it sounds like we're down in the weeds here, but it's very important stuff because I think what we're arriving at the conclusion is what the stretch is mandated that you do is start planning even earlier, both financially and for your estate. If you're going to manage the money in the way that the stretch allowed you to do, you really need to start much sooner than perhaps you otherwise would have anticipated. So folks in their early 30s, 40s, 50s, okay, we have to start not just thinking about a plan, but actually acting on one. And I think that time is now. I think we're going to beat this drum for quite a few months into 2020, but it's something that really needs to be taken, you know, kind of as a resolution to get out there and think about it a different way now.
So this may just be a one word answer because it's so simple, but as far as it goes, what changes between me and my spouse inheriting my IRA? Anything? Does all that stay the same?
Really nothing changes there because okay. They the spouse has the right to name that IRA as their IRA. So they do not have to have RMDs or any spend down whatsoever. The spouses are protected. They're good.
We're going over some changes that happen, legally speaking, to a bunch of these accounts. And right as we stepped into the break, I was asking Gregory and Wes, what first things first, between me and my spouse, any of those rules changed? Because it's been super nice. The spousal exception on your IRA is the only way that someone else can basically just take over possession of your IRA without it being some kind of taxable event or other complications. It's been really the simplest way to pass along an IRA. That's still all intact, right? The whole spousal exception, that's still good. They can just retitle it in their name.
That's it.
Okay, cool. Now, there's some other exceptions in there when we talk about the stretch went away. What are they left with? Does that mean if there's an exception, does that mean they could retitle it in their name? Does that mean they can still do the stretch? Does that mean their 10-year window just doesn't start until later, but they can't do the stretch with the divisor or whatever?
Well, it's still an inherited account, so titling's going to be an issue. They're inheriting the money. That's just like before. They set up an inherited account, and titling has to be right just because it has to mention the decedent's name and such in there, because IRS wants to be able to track that money. It's just where in the past, the old rules, if somebody died in 2019, they still have the stretch option. And if they're a non-spouse beneficiary, then they have to set up a Benny IRA account, and they have to start RMDs year after death, and they continue there forward. Now, they're not locked into doing a stretch. They could spend all the money out the next month or however fast they want to over whatever period of time. The difference is now with the stretch gone, it basically states you have to take all the money out of that account within 10 years. You don't have to take any out year one, year two, three, or four, but year 10, you're required to withdraw the balance of the account. That's your required minimum distribution, is 100% of the account in year 10. So we still have to retitle. We have to shift money, you know, and typically there's more than one beneficiary of IRAs and such, because there's, you know, it would be the spouse be primary. Secondary would be the kids. Most families have more than one kid, I'd say. So there's typically more than one beneficiary, so that money has to be split according to the designations of the account. That answer your question, James?
That starts the answer to my question. There could be more. Wes, you have a follow-up on that?
No, all that makes sense.
Okay. 504-260-0995 if you have any more questions on there. All right, so when we look at other aspects of estate planning that are affected by this, something that came up in my mind is they relaxed the rules a little bit on what you can invest in your 401k and IRA. You can now use fixed products, right? Or index
link. Before we jump to that, I want to mention one other option that I have a list, and this would be charitable remainder trusts that could be set up. Those are irrevocable trusts, but a charitable remainder trust is a tax-exempt, irrevocable trust designed to reduce taxable income of individuals by first dispersing income to the beneficiaries of the trust for a specified period of time, then donating the remainder of the trust to a designated charity. This is a split interest giving vehicle that allows a trustor to make contributions, be eligible for a partial tax deduction, and donate the remaining assets. So this is something you get down more in the weeds on, but it's another option to utilize these big accounts.
Sorry to jump on you there.
Yeah.
Let's do Dan in Metairie. Dan in Metairie, you're on Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Dan?
I have a real estate asset that I would like to sell, and my wife doesn't. Can I sell it without her approval?
Well, I think that boils down to how it's titled. If you guys are joint owners, you guys are going to need to sell that together. If you guys are titled together on that, they're going to ask for two signatures when you sell that asset.
What state do you live in, Dan?
Louisiana.
Louisiana. So it's community property. So what if it's titled in his name, but they're in a community property state. As it depend on when she acquired, when that was acquired, because when, she has community interest.
When and how? So the rule is that a presumption is in effect that after marriage, any asset that you acquire, including real estate, is presumed to be community property. Doesn't matter whether that is held as a single title asset or not, but it's presumed to be community. In that case, you can look to see whether there was any sort of declaration as to whether that property, although acquired during a marriage, was declared as separate. But if that's not there, then it is presumed again to be community. So it rolls right back around to the titling issue. If it's held jointly by spouses, then both spouses are going to need to sign off on that sale.
I've had a long time, so I'll have to go look at the title.
Over here on the Facebook Live feed, Gregory, we have a question about some changes that were made to the Stretch account. This is from Mary. Her question is, if a Stretch account was set up in the past, does it keep going as it was originally set up, or does it have to change in accordance with the new law?
The old rules are grandfathered. So if somebody died in 2019 or earlier, 2018, 2011, 2005, before 1998. So, yeah, it's under the old rule. So the stretch option stays the stretch option. You're not going to have to accelerate that money. Now, one thing that's coming is the required minimum distribution tables are going to be adjusted for longevity. So you might see the amount you have to take may slightly decrease. So that's one of the things that, and that's a positive thing for you from that standpoint, but that's something that's coming, and we're not expecting that to be put in place till 2021, the adjustments on the amount of RMDs, meaning the RMD tables are going to be adjusted a little bit.
Well, that was a great question from Mary. Thank you very much for properly utilizing the Facebook Live comment feed. And if you have a question, or Mary, if you have a follow-up, you can just leave it in the comments, or you can call 504-260-0995. That's something we're going to deal with for the rest of the hour here and there. Secure Act changes the rules around IRAs, 401ks, some of these trusts, a little bit of estate planning. Contributions, distributions, required minimum distributions, a lot of rule changes we're trying to keep you updated with on the show here.
Google this. What's the U.S. population?
About 320 million, 330 million.
Okay, the population of the United States was projected by the Census Bureau to be 330 million as of the beginning of this year.
Okay.
So I was just curious if we had hit that mark.
327.2 is the 2018 number.
Well,
that's the last official one I'm pretty seeing right here.
Pretty close. Let's see. Natural increase in U.S. population in 2019. Births in excess of deaths was just 957,000.
We got more than that from immigration.
Okay, so moving back to this, so population is neighborhood of 330 million as of beginning of the year then. 50 years ago, that's in 1970, our nation's decennial census, and that occurs once again every 10 years, measured the population at 203 million. 100 years ago, 1920, our population was 106 million.
That was big enough to win a world war, though.
Any thoughts about that? That's like over 100 years we've tripled in population.
Yeah, I think an important observation on that info is the Malthusian people that are saying we need to stop having so many people, or we're all going to starve, or the planet's overpopulated, we need to stop having so many kids. They're all wrong. The record of history is crystal clear. The more human beings on this planet, the better things get. The more human beings on this planet, the better the average human being standard of living gets, the better average standard of living for the human at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale.
It's not getting worse.
Right.
It's getting better. I agree.
All right, let's do Chuck and Gonzalez. Chuck, you, sir, are on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Chuck?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Chuck. You're on the show. You're on the air.
Yeah, My wife is 59. I'm 61. We both have 401ks, and my wife has a small one, 401k, around 50,000. And her company is fixing to close the doors, and I don't know if she'll go back to work. So, wondering what'd be some good advice to do with her 401k.
What area are y'all from? Our screen is Gonzales area.
Gonzales, Louisiana.
Okay. So she, with the company closing, she wasn't intending to retire until this has came up, right?
That's correct. Well, I don't know when she'll be able to go back to work, you know?
Okay.
So is
there a reason? Is there something else besides the company closing when you say you don't know when she'll be able to go back to work? Because the company closing won't prevent her from working elsewhere.
No, it won't. It's just... you know, I don't know how long it'll take her to find another job.
Basically. Yeah. Okay. So now we get into, jobs, training, and it is, I get that completely. So now she has the ability to, if they have a 401k, and you mentioned they did, she has the chance to roll that over to a rollover IRA account outside of that 401k. One of her options will be in the future also, full disclosure, is if she does go to work somewhere else with a 401k, she could roll that plan money over to that plan as well.
Right.
I like the idea of rolling it over to an IRA because you have so many choices, risk choices, low risk, and no risk. It gives you a lot of planning opportunities there.
Okay. So if I roll it over to an IRA, we'll have to pay taxes on it.
That I'm glad you asked that because when you do a rollover, meaning go from one custodian to the next, that is not a taxable event. So when you roll that money over from the 401k to a assuming it's a traditional 401k, roll it over to a traditional IRA rollover account, that is not a taxable event. Whenever you're taking money out or she takes a distribution that's paid to her, that will be a taxable event because that money, well, assuming it's all pre-tax money, and it'll be taxed as ordinary income when it does come out.
Liz in Madison, you're on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Liz?
I have an RMD question for Gregory. My question is, the withdrawal that I have to take, would it be better to take on a monthly basis or a yearly basis? I do not need the RMD that I'm having to withdraw to live on.
What is your age, Liz, if you don't mind sharing?
72.
Okay. Yeah, under the new rules, RMDs for 2020 start at age 72, so you don't get to skip a year. You've had to take it past couple of years and continue doing so, but you don't need the money.
Right.
Now, if for people that especially are needing the money, you know, I like it to be systematized, so to speak, that you're used to taking income. In our working life, we, get paid typically biweekly. We receive income every month. So for most people going into retirement and taking distributions, I like that to be systematized that way to mirror how we're always used to taking income. Now, we also, for an RMD standpoint, we do have a number of people that just prefer that distribution to be once a year. And we like to systematize that so it's automatic. But then we have other people like, I don't know when I'll take it this year. I'll let you know. We just always like it to be done before December because we don't want to fall behind and miss this and you get that ugly penalty. So it's really going to be what your preference is. If you'd like to receive a check every month, a quarterly check, or once a year, Liz.
Okay.
Does that help you?
I wasn't sure. Right. I just wasn't sure about it. I know I have to pay. I've only taken one withdrawal so far, and I took it, increment and paid the taxes then. So, but I just had heard different things. Oh, maybe it's better to take it on a monthly basis, but I don't need it. So you've answered my question, and thanks for the help.
Thank you, Liz, for calling and listening to Winning at Life. I'll share one other thought. Now, the argument could be, depending on how that money is working, you one of the thoughts would be to push it off towards the back end of the year and take it lump sum. So, yeah, I'd like to keep it at work before I have to take it out and pay some taxes on it. So that would be one reason to defer is letting it keep doing the work that it's doing until the back end of the year, just so long as you don't miss that. And keep in mind that you need, when you take an RMD, everybody listening, everybody that has to take distributions, or you take a distribution from a qualified account, you need to cash that check inside of this tax year. So in 2020, you need to cash those checks inside of that, because the IRS, you could say, well, I'm going to push off the tax bill. I've taken the RMD, but I'm going to deposit in the account the following year. Well, you can do that, but they're still going to go and say that goes on the 2020 tax year, or whenever you were supposed to, or when that check was issued. They're going to want it to go on the tax year that that check was issued. Just keep that in mind as well.
Todd Mandeville, you're on Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Todd?
I have a question. I'm kind of getting concerned about how my taxes are going to be play out when I come into retirement. And just to give you my scenario, I roughly have about $300,000 saved all in a traditional 401k, and I'm going to have probably about $500,000 from my pension, and I have about 21 more years to work. And I'm just curious, should I start just fully investing post-tax, or should there be a split, you know, traditional and after-tax? I'm wondering how to move forward with my investing.
Okay, so you do have, you're already thinking about tax efficiency. How am I going to be taxed later? What I would dislike is having all of my income under forced rules, like RMDs down the road. I would dislike all of my income taxed as ordinary income. You know, when you invest money, say in stocks, for example, after tax, and you hold them over a year, you have a capital gains tax versus ordinary income tax. If you're putting money into Roth, that money's going to come out without being taxed, and won't, and under the present rules, it does not even show up on the 1040. It's not going to cause your Medicare premiums to go up. It's not pushing you into other tax brackets. So I think you need to think about how are you going to blend. So I've spoke of three tax worlds: the pre-tax, we're putting money away and growing, the tax-free world, and then creating a step-up basis. And if anything, blend that. Get money working in all three of those tax worlds that we have. What do you think of that, Todd?
Listen, y'all have my phone number. If you guys want to give me a call and give me some guidance.
Okay. I'll have somebody follow up with you, Todd.
Yeah, hey, and you know, that's...
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Todd. That's not a strange thing to do. If you don't want to be on the radio, you can just call in, give Angie, the producer, your phone number.
You know, if they want somebody to call, we will call them, because otherwise, you know, you're calling in. You're not exposing yourself to us calling you or anything like that. We don't call people back that call the show. So you are safe. But if you want a call back, we will follow up with you.
Keith Thibodeau, what can we do for you, Keith?
Hey, Gregory. I was told one time that when I reach 62, I should sign up for Social Security and then defer it. And then when my wife, which is a couple of years younger than me, reaches 62, she could sign up and get my income, since I have more working hours in Social Security than what she has. So that's the first part of my question. The second part, if she does go against my Social Security, does it stop my Social Security growth? Say I would reach the maximum for Social Security as far as working time limits.
A spouse drawing the spousal income from Social Security against your work record has no effect on your work record. And we've talked about in the past where you could have an ex-spouse. You were married for 10 years. They have the right to draw off of your work record because they were married to you for 10 years. You could have had a new wife every 10 years. So you could have three or four spouses eligible to draw off your work record, and that will not hurt your work record. Now let's go back to the first part. There is no file and suspend. You can turn on your work record at age 62, but gosh, that's way early. You can't and then defer, because when you turn on Social Security, you're turning it on. For them to draw a spousal benefit, you have to have your Social Security turned on. There's no file and defer. There's no file and suspend in that case. Now, for them to draw from the spousal benefit, you're really talking about full retirement age, and a spousal benefit is based upon your full retirement age if they're going to draw that, and then that benefit would be reduced if they are turning it on early. But you have to be drawing your benefit for a spouse to sign up to draw their benefit. Okay, so what he had called about was asking, could he turn on and defer his Social Security? Basically talking about that old thing that used to be in place where you could file and suspend once you reached FRA, full retirement age. And for people kind of are at age 66 becoming FRAs or cycling right now, he would turn on that under the old rules that went away back in 2015. They did away with it. You could file for Social Security, then suspend it. And if your spouse was FRA, she could turn it on and receive that spousal benefit. She could restrict it to her benefit and continue to defer hers. But even to do that part, you had to be born before January 2nd of 1954.
So okay. Rules have changed since somebody told me that.
Yes, the rules are quite different now. So as far as what are you eligible to do, you have to have your record turned on for a spouse to draw a spousal benefit. Depending on when they were born, they could restrict it to the spousal benefit and defer their work record. But if they're born after January 2nd of 1954, when they turn on their benefit, they're turning on, whether it's connected to your work record gives them more, that 50%, or their own work record, whichever is larger. And it doesn't matter when you turn yours on. You could turn yours on at 62, and if they choose to wait to their FRA, they would be able to draw 100% of the 50% of your FRA number. They're not turning on or getting 50% because you turned it on at 62. You're the one that took the discount. If they turned it on, they're drawing 50% of your FRA number. Now, if they're not FRA, it will be reduced because they turned it on early. Yeah. I know that's a lot information there. Hopefully that helps. Any other questions?
So, just to clarify, if I am capable to continue working till full retirement age, I should, without turning on Social Security.
Correct. Because you also, there's an income earnings test for 2019 at $17,640. I've not looked at the new number for 2020. So if you make more than that, so every $2 more than that you make, they take back a dollar. You don't really want to turn that on. And look, here's how Social Security looks at your FRA number. The way Social Security looks at it, your Social Security number is your FRA number. They don't look at, oh, well, he's eligible at 62. Everybody should look at your Social Security benefit is based upon your full retirement age number. If you're turning it on early, you could be penalized. It is going to be reduced. There's an income test. The greatest benefit is deferring beyond that if it makes sense mathematically and correlating to your assets and health. There's so many things to factor. Continue, Keith.
Correct. So if my wife decides, well, and again, my income over the years have always been greater than hers. So if she reaches full retirement age or any retirement age, I don't know, you have to clarify that statement. She could turn on, if the amount is greater than what she would normally get under her Social Security. But, and I know it's 50%, that's what you said.
Yes.
She could start drawing my Social Security, and I would not be penalized.
You would not be penalized if she turns on the spousal benefit based upon your work record.
Yeah. So my Social Security could continue to grow until full retirement age.
Right. But she cannot draw off of it a spousal benefit until you actually have turned yours on. That we have to be clear on that as well. That yours has to be activated and drawing it. And let's say, for example, you started it and you changed your mind and stopped it, and she had turned hers on and was drawing your spousal, that would cease hers as well, to be clear.
Yeah.
I just keep throwing out more and more information to you to complicate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Winning at Life, Keith. Tell a friend about the show.
You know, I suspect there were similar conversations that were being had at the Social Security Lunch and Learn this week.
Oh, we talked about that. There's variations of those questions. And, you know, it was pretty much me giving content for an hour, solid hour of just, and people would ask questions. And it's just, it's a lot of information. But the important part is, and one of the key things I shared right there is you are supposed to look at what is your Social Security benefit. It's your FRA number. It's not the 62 or 63 or 64 or 65. It's whatever your full retirement age number is, how they look at the benefit. You do have the opportunity to grow it more by deferring. So on an annual basis, it's equivalent of about 8% a year, but you're credited monthly for each month you defer. Now, if you turn it on at 62, you're taking a discounted amount. If you look at what, if you turn it on at 62 and say, well, if I turn it on at 62, how much, and if I change my mind and don't turn it on at 60, how much is it growing from 62 to FRA? It's growing about 6 2/3% on an annualized basis, but you're credited each month you defer. But we shouldn't talk about deferring from 62. We should talk about deferring from full retirement age to age 70, which is the max there.
Yeah, and I don't think Keith was as familiar with the different times you could turn it on. There's full retirement age. The other one, it's the other age you mentioned, 62, that's early retirement. And then if you want to take it later, get the bigger benefit.
That, you know,
there's not really a term for that, late start, max benefit, whatever.
Yeah, and everybody's situation is completely different. Everybody's work record, the credits, their best 35 years, everybody's different. Everybody's retirement assets is different. Everybody's income. One of the key things, what is all this? It's about monthly checks, monthly income, and everybody's need is different. I don't ever have the same request. So this really comes down to the most important question when somebody comes in and talks to my team and I about generating income. It's just, what is the monthly income that you need? It can be a want, but it's also a need as well. That and that's a net. That's an after-tax number, because we're kind of, what does it take for you to pay the bills? What does it take for you to continue your lifestyle? Social Security plays into that. Pension, that side gig, income from assets. Because, you know, you have a lot of time, why I say side gig, people say, well, you know, I'm going to do some part-time work and such. You should, when you're thinking about building towards that number, do not factor in a side gig. Because most of the time, we've shown, statistics have shown, that doesn't happen how you expect it to do so. And if you don't have outside, and why all this has to be talked about, because all this has to be correlated, with your health. Sometimes that spouse and her income is turned on early. We know the spousal Social Security can't be turned on if you've not turned yours on, but I'm talking about the working spouse has a work record. So sometimes the math tells us that that's good to go ahead and get that income started while you continue to defer your work record. Then there are situations we have to talk about where there's just not enough money and you're turning on Social Security because you need that monthly income in retirement. And that's why it's important to have a sit down and talk about Social Security. That's where we are. Big game on Monday night. I think it kicks off about 7:15.
Okay, great.
And I have some great seats for the game.
Where are you going?
My couch.
That's right. Best seat in the house.
Yeah.
Gregory, I have a conundrum, and this is a financial conundrum having to do with the championship game. Two problems. Number one is Mississippi legalized sports betting, and they're just next door. Like, I could be there in 40 minutes. This show is based out of the New Orleans area, by the way, if you didn't know. So we could go over to the coast right now and drop some sports bets on
you
the LSU
could.
Game.
Could.
Gregory.
But you think that would be fun?
LSU right now is expected to win, but the spread is only 5.5 points.
But, you know, I heard 80 to 90% of the betting is going on LSU. To me, that's, I don't believe that
it
because
can.
The spread would be pushed, keep being pushed up because mm-hmm. the part of the spread, and that's where when somebody's writing articles say, well, you know, all the betting's going on LSU. Well, that's a scary thing because everybody can't be right. But with that said, as I understand sports betting and the spread is to try to keep the betting balanced.
It does.
Because, you know, that's what would, you know, the bookies don't want to have to pay out 90% of the bettors. Yeah. So they're losing and they don't want to lose. So I don't know how all that works. And I've not thought or fooled with sports betting in about 40 years. I did the time after college, and I started going into this industry and such, but there was a very brief time I worked the math out. Okay, like how can you figure this out and win more than 50% of the time? And after, I think, about a year of fooling with the math of that, I figured out you can't. So I've never done it since. I have no interest in betting on a game or parlay or any of that because to me, then that would take the fun out. Like I've got money at stake, you know, and I don't like to lose money. So that would like take the fun out of it. So I don't bet on sports or you know, I don't put money at risk that way, period. You know that.
Okay, but Gregory, you know. I'm about to say some things that I know are really crazy, but it makes sense right now. Number one. What a sure shot. Not only am I sure LSU is going to win, I am sure they're going to win by at least 6 points. So this 5.5 spread, this is the closest thing to a sure shot that I've seen in a long time. Does that sound crazy? Of course, that's what every gambler who loses his butt
yeah,
says.
I think LSU wins by 2 touchdowns, but you still have to play the game. They might only win by 1 point. So they can win the game but not cover. So, you know, that happens a lot of the time.
You need to talk me out of going to the bank after the show, pulling $1,000 out and going over the coast and putting it down.
You're not going to do that.
Talk me out. Why not? Why wouldn't I do that?
Because you might be wrong.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not going to name names, but I had somebody a few weeks ago talk about putting a bet on a pro football team. Just say if you bet $1,000... You could pay off your whole Christmas with the money you would win. And I said, that's the most insane thing I've ever heard. And it turned out if that advice had been followed, they would have. And that advice was, this is a sure thing. This is a lock. And they were wrong. That person would have lost $1,000.
Was this an overexcited Saints fan of some sort?
See, of some sort.
Keep telling me
not
these stories.
Not naming names or teams, but it's called a bet and they're putting odds on it for a reason. And then, you know, that's probably then here's the problem with doing it. Then you're like worried about your $1,000, you know, it's to me, that's just craziness, but look, a lot of people do it and probably some of the people, they really enjoy it. That's fun for them. It's not fun for me. I don't think it would be fun for you either.
Only if I win.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's like buying stocks. People are happy when they go up, but when they go down, what are they? Unhappy. Oh, I'm sure if I bet, I'd be joyed to win, but I would truly be miserable if I was lost. And then if I'm watching the game and I'm losing the whole time during the game, how that means the game's no fun. I'm like miserable. or you're euphoric and, oh my God, I'm winning some money. And then all of a sudden at the end, it's grabbed away from you. You've seen that in games that all of a sudden the outcome at the end's completely different. There was a Super Bowl
28-3
that was locked in the first half. Woo! And then that team had that kind of ridiculously, and then they lost the game.
Best Super
Bowl. By the end.
Best Super Bowl ever, wasn't it? Wasn't
that the best one? Here, we've got, let's move on.
Oh, yeah, you got a question on the app?
Yeah, there's a question from the app here. Joey, I just call him Joey.
It's probably Burrow.
It is not, okay. But we'll just call him Joey. Originally from California, back in the 80s, I owed back child support, he's saying. I don't owe any now, but during that time, California charged interest on what I owed. It became so messed up. They said at one time I owed over $200,000 in interest, which is over 200 times what the principal was. They have been doing an audit. He calls it an audit since 1992, but I think that term, they're taking it.
Garnish.
They're garnishing him.
Okay.
$69 a week from his check. He also says, I haven't filed taxes since like 1989, but wait, I pay in every year. I don't owe the IRS. I would get a refund every year, but California would take it. So my question is, I'm 55 now. When I retire in 10 years, will me not filing affect my retirement? You need to call Jude Heath. You need to file your taxes. Just because you don't owe does not make it okay. And that is just, oh my gosh. And you need to have this resolve with California as well on what's going on there. You need to talk to a CPA. Jude Heath is a show contributor. I recommend you talk to him or somebody else where in your area, wherever you are. You talk to them and talk about this. You need to look into this. This could very well affect what you're planning to do in retirement. That's my thoughts. And that's why I wanted to get that in, because there's situations out there where people hadn't filed taxes and maybe have some garnishments, and you need to have a handle on this. That just, it gives me chills, scares me for this fella.
Well, at some point in similar stories like this, you go from needing a tax attorney to needing a criminal attorney. And that's not the fun transition you want to make. I'm just amazed he's gotten away with it for this long.
Yeah, I think that might be a bigger mess underlying there.
Well, this might, on the upside, this might be a new Winning at Life radio show record. He hasn't filed taxes in 31 years. I think that's a record for the show, right? Didn't that? Studio audience loves it. They're impressed. All right, Greg, tell them about your day job, some events. How can people get more now that the show's about to end?
Well, we have a Social Security Lunch and Learn as well as an event later in the day. That's going to be on February the 4th. And so we're going to talk about a bunch of Social Security rules, how that stuff works, how to correlate it with your assets, how to get the most out of it, limited seating. But that's something you can attend. We have a wine, wisdom, and food experience coming up. We're going to talk about managed money. We're going to talk about reducing or eliminating risk. We're going to talk about the Secure Act. And, yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm going to give you some wine tips, foodie tips, multiple courses paired with wine over 2 hours. We're going to have a great time. That's at Rizzuto's in New Orleans. That's January 22nd. As well. And I'm not sure if I have something coming up before then, but if you're wanting to come into an office, you've heard me on the show here saying, hey, I need some help. Whether it's Gulfport, Mississippi, Mandeville, Louisiana, Metairie, Louisiana, call 504-832-9200 or go to GregoryRicks.com. See you there.
Your home away from the show, winningitlife.com and the Winning It Life app. Also on GregoryRicks.com, if you go to the blog, we have a bunch of write-ups on the ways the Secure Act is changing your retirement rules. So go do some reading there. All right, go LSU. I'm James Parker. We're Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks.
Investment advisory services offered only by duly registered individuals through AE Wealth Management, LLC. AE Wealth Management, Gregory Ricks & Associates, W.J. Blanchard Law, LLC, J. Heath & Company, and Mortgage Gumbo are not affiliated companies. Investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Any references to protection, safety, or lifetime income generally refer to fixed insurance products, never securities or investments. Insurance guarantees are backed by the financial strength and claims-paying abilities of the issuing carrier. This radio show is intended for informational purposes only. It is not intended to be used as the sole basis for financial decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the particular needs of an individual situation. Annuities are insurance contracts designed for retirement or other long-term needs. They provide guarantees of principal and credited interest subject to surrender charges. Annuity guarantees and protections are backed by the financial strength and claims paying ability of the issuing insurer. Hypothetical examples have been provided for illustrative purposes only. It does not represent a real-life scenario and should not be construed as advice designed to meet the particular needs of an individual situation. Gregory Ricks and Associates is not permitted to offer, and no statement made during the show shall constitute legal or tax advice. Our firm is not affiliated or endorsed by the U.S. government or any governmental agency. The information and opinions contained herein provided by third parties have been obtained from sources believed to be reliable, but accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed by Gregory Ricks and Associates. We are Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.